and maybe even use gas and come in and at least possibly penetrate portions of our line and come in maybe as far as my command post. I felt that they may be able to come into my command post because we had some people that could man sort of the inner defenses. We had recon company as a backup. We had Captain Snyder's little force. And then, of course, I had my own staff there in the bunker. And we had trenches dug around that. And I felt that we could hold there until maybe the weather broke and we got some air support and we could call some air in on us, but we would never lose the base. We'd never lose Quezon Combat Base. But we might have a temporary major probe until we were able to kill them and push them back.
Well, was the air support instrumental in keeping the NVA, you know, at a certain distance from the base?
Well, the air support was definitely a very strong factor, a very key factor in keeping the enemy back. We had the B-52s that were brought in closer than they'd ever been brought into ground troops in the history of warfare. I think later events showed that large numbers of the enemy were either killed or put out of battle because of B-52 strikes. I think it was also a psychological problem for the NVA when they never saw the B-52s, but they had many friends who had been killed by the B-52s. Another part of the air war that helped us a lot were the what we call TPQs, which were radar bombing at night. And this used to sort of provide entertainment for us. We could listen in on their frequencies and these were missions flown by not large bombers, but by basically small aircraft from either carriers or Da Nang or Chulai. And not just Marines, they were Marines, Air Force. On occasion, I even heard Australian pilots flying them, and God knows who all were flying those missions all night long. And this had to impact on the enemy because we would plot during the day points around the base that we felt the enemy may be harboring themselves in, or may have a mortar set up here, or a little ammo dump here, or an aid station here. And then all night long, our aircraft would come in on these TPQs, these radar controlled bomb missions. And they would be told when to pickle their bombs, when to pickle their armament, and this helped. The third and also important part was the Marine close air support. We had a lot of that real tall grass growing around one side of the combat base. In fact, it was the same side that the water point was on. And we tried to get that burn out. And we were able a couple of times to get some Marine pilots to come up and drop some napalm on that because that was providing cover up real close to the positions. And the Marines would come up and not only drop napalm, but if we had some specific targets, they would drop snake eyes and other sophisticated ordnance on the known enemy concentrations. We had Air Force flare ships. We had the C-130s that would, if we ever needed, would come up and kick out flares. We had our lines marked. We never had to use this, but we had provisions for half of a 55-gallon drum filled with gasoline, spotted around to mark our own trenches. We had flares mounted on some of our key bunkers, so that had the need arisen, we could have marked our lines, and then the spooky one for the Air Force plane that has the mini cannon that would come up and just sort of like it would look like a fire hose firing tracer, and they would come up periodically during the night at our request, and they would sort of hose down the trenches. The flare ship would drop the flares, and then the gunship would come up and hose down the trenches for us. when I say hose down, of course, not with water, but with the very powerful ordnance that they had. So we had a lot of things working for us up there in the way of aviation.
Okay, what about...
We also had, may I go about the
Air Force? Please, yeah.
The Air Force, the Marines flew, we had a few 130s, we had about, I think, in Vietnam, we had either eight or nine or ten C-130s in country. And one morning I was out walking around, and a Marine C-130 came in. And normally the pilots had been briefed that you don't come into caisson and circle around like you're, you know, Lindbergh about to land in Paris. You come in and make a straight shot in, and you land, you kick your cargo out, and you take off. Somehow this pilot had to circle. He came in from the east, and unfortunately he circled right near Hill 1015, which was where this Chu Hoi lieutenant had told us his company was. And so they opened up on with some anti-aircraft, very unsophisticated anti-aircraft, but immediately hit his C-130. It started smoking. He was able to come down, complete his little half circle, and land, but he was sort of limping as he landed. It turned out that he was carrying some, I think, 55-gallon drums of gasoline or some sort of fuel. He had some poor passengers in there also. He started smoking heavily, and as soon as he sort of crash-landed it, and I think most of those people were killed. Possibly there were one or two survivors. The crash crew got to the plane and put some fog on it. And that crashed right behind, I mean, it ended up right behind my bunker.
It's a pretty dramatic crash.
Hmm?
Could you describe the crash a little bit more? We got a lot of footage of this particular.
Well, I think it was, the dramatic part was that you sort of knew what was going to happen to the pilot. For one thing, it was a shock that he did not come and land directly onto the airstrip. He possibly, maybe the wind threw him off course and he had to, but he came so close to the where we had already heard the anti-aircraft guns shoot. The first day, or first or second day of the big battle, a Marine jet plane got shot down by these same guns. And if they can shoot down a jet, you know, we knew they could shoot down an old C-130. So the fact that we heard the guns fire, we could sort of hear the plane take the hits, he sort of started smoking. And we knew, you know, we were there on the ground hoping and praying, God, let him land, let him land, let him land. And he was able to sort of limp on in. And it was very dramatic because you felt a great deal of compassion for the people inside the plane when you saw the smoke billowing out and billowing out and billowing out. And then finally when he sort of brought it into a sort of a crash landing, you sort of had to give up hope for the people inside. But so that was one of the when the first C-130 crashed. Now, and at that point in time, as I understand it, the Marines did not let any more Marine C-130s come into caisson. The Air Force gave us a tremendous amount of support by using C-130s with LAPES. Low altitude parachute extraction, which is also sort of dramatic. If you have any footage of that, and I'm sure you got, the Air Force, I'm sure it's got miles of footage of LAPES extraction. It's when the C-130 comes down just a few feet off the runway and kicks out a parachute, and the parachute then opens and pulls out the, extracts the cargo, and it turns its own slides, and it slides across the runway. In fact, they came in so close, I had one of my casualties, I had one Marine killed, was actually struck by a C-130 that was not crashing, was not out of control. He was just struck by part of the wing. We also got supplies by parachute, which were dropped on the western side of the base. But another real lifesaver were the Air Force C-130s. The C-130s landed on the airstrip.
C-123s?
C-123s. C-123s landed on the airstrip, had their cargo mounted on pallets with rollers on it, would push out the cargo, and then turn around, take on passengers, and then take off.
Could you describe the process of offloading, you know, new troops coming in, people going back for R&R, just because I have a lot of footage of that too?
Well, to give an example of some of the things that happened, I needed a senior enlisted man as my S3 chief, which is, let's say, a gunnery sergeant's job. Let's say my man had gone home and had not been replaced. My adjutant received word that the new man was coming up on the next plane. Well, he never arrived, and we found out that that was an aircraft that was shot down, not close to Quezon, but I don't think you'd have any footage of this, but it was well to the east, let's say between Quezon and Camp Carroll. And that was probably the one major loss of life indirectly attributable to Quezon. I've forgotten how many men were on that plane, but everyone, in fact, it took weeks and weeks and weeks to even reach the plane. The plane was in very dense undergrowth, and possibly part of the time it was in enemy territory before we opened things up. But I think there were over 35 people on that plane coming in to fly in replacements to Quezon. And that one never got close to Quezon. So then we went back to, my adjutant went back and said, look, we still need a gunnery sergeant with a certain MOS. He said, fine, he's coming up. Well, he happened to the next replacement to take this man's place came up on a helicopter. The helicopter was shot down. So then at that point in time, I maybe thought that that particular billet was jinxing the aircraft, and I told the adjutant to forget it, and I replaced him with a staff NCO from one of my companies. I never flew into Quezon under those conditions, but when I met the troops, or when the troops were, you know, brought in to be sort of indoctrinated, they were in a state of shock. Even let's say troopers that had a previous tour in Vietnam back in the old days of 1965 and 66, when you had punchy traps and single shot rifles and things like that, and when they came into Quezon, you know, the enemy was using 130mm artillery and rockets and everything else. So it had to be traumatic, because they sort of had to, as soon as the plane landed, they had to leave, or as soon as the helicopter landed, they had to leave and get off the airstrip and probably ask a lot of directions, who do I go to, where is my company, and this, that, and the other. But the departure was probably, could also be even more traumatic, because there were little sort of waiting areas that were sandbagged areas that you would wait in, and the C-123s would come in and push out their cargo, and then turn around, and then there was a radio communication between the C-123 and a Marine in this little holding area. And everybody would be sort of husbanded there, right, waiting for the word to come from the C-123, because the pilot of the 123 didn't want a lot of people rushing out while he was still kicking out the cargo. He wanted the cargo to get loose. So then the word would come, okay, men, load them up. And you may or may not have a few more, usually you'd have a few mortar rounds dropping around. And so it became particularly traumatic if a person had endured a 13-month tour in Vietnam, and he was flying out of Quezon to go home for good, or if he was flying back to meet his wife on R&R in Hawaii, and he may not arrive in the best mental spirits if he had to go through a mortar barrage to get on his plane taking him out.
Of course, you know that story in here. About the poor little turkey.
Mayhew.
He goes up three times.
Yeah, that's a great story.
To leave the country. His tour is up. And for one reason or another, it's hard to explain whether it's voluntary or involuntary. He keeps missing the plane and coming back to the company.
That's a real good story, a very touching story that you write.
Well, why don't we talk a little bit, you talk a little bit about the hill, what was going on the hills, because at least in terms of misconceptions of the battle, to say a person watching television here on San Carlos in 1968 would assume that the battle was going on at the combat base and not, you know, at the various hills surrounding it.
Well, the hills probably played an important role in keeping the pressure off the combat base. I can recall Colonel Lowndes hosting a conference of himself, his executive officer, his regimental S3, myself, and I think my exec and possibly my S3. And this was in the fall of 67, when the monsoon was about to hit us. We were having more fog. The hills were having to be resupplied by helicopter. And he posed a question for our consideration. He said, how do you feel, what's your opinion, or what are your recommendations about evacuating the hills, 881 and 861? I don't think there was ever any consideration to abandoning Hill 950 because it did not take but one platoon. Only one platoon could stay up there. And then, but you could take two companies, put them back someplace else if you took them off 881 and 861. So we kicked the idea around quite a while at this meeting. And there were several things that we had to consider. One was since there had been such a tremendous play in the press when the hill battles had gone on earlier, 881, 861, and 881 North, we considered the political ramifications. You gave so many lives to take these hills back in the spring. Why are you now giving them up? If they were important then, why are they important now? But we decided that that really was not a factor. We should not even consider that. We should only consider our own immediate situation. And I gave my recommendation that we not abandon the hills. For two key reasons. Number one, I felt that if we did receive an attack, that they could not take Quezon Combat Base unless they controlled the hills. And I felt that the hills that it would take a large number of enemy to take either 861 or 881 because of the nature of the terrain. There was a second reason. I normally tried to keep a company out on patrol even during the monsoons. And I was able, on several occasions, to use either 881 or 861 as a safe haven if, for example, if the monsoons really got bad and a company had been out for 3 or 4 or 5 days and continually pouring rain, they needed some shelter, they needed a safe haven, not from the enemy, but from the elements. So on more than one occasion, I was able to move the company in and let the company on 881 host the company that had been out in the field and help them get their clothing dried out. Maybe provide them with a change of socks or whatever, and then they could go back out the next day and resume the patrol. I also felt that was they would provide sort of an early warning if we ever had an attack, because we sort of felt that the threat may come from that particular direction. So, as far as the people on the hills, I had a lot of, deep feeling because my people had worked so hard on Hill 881 and 861, particularly Captain John Raymond, who had been the company commander of B Company before Captain Snyder had taken over. John had just done a yeoman-like job of improving particularly Hill 881 and then later on 861 before he was reassigned to a recon company. And John left right before the battle started, and to this day he regrets having not been able to participate in the battles of either of those hills. But I must say that I really did not keep up with what was going on the hills, because I was more concerned with what was going on in my own front yard. Now, I was concerned about Hill 861 because I had two platoons from A Company up there reinforcing and attached to the company that happened to be on 861. But I do know that they were fighting their own battles. They had their own little battles, and we had ours. Right in the beginning, of course, there was some very heavy fighting on the hills. And they had to endure some hardships that we did not have to endure. I think we got a lot more incoming at Kasan Combat Base than they got on the hills. But earlier on, they had more, they had heavier probes. They actually had attacks, particularly 861 had some strong attacks. But as the battle wore on, the enemy seemed to be pouring most of his incoming artillery and mortar onto down there where we were staying. I did have a lot of concern for Hill 950 because we only had one platoon up there. The enemy had people up on 1015. The enemy had a 50 caliber mounted up on 1015 that could just sort of plop 50 caliber rounds right down in the 950, which they did with impunity. We did a little risk taking up on 950. 950 could not be resupplied unless the weather was really good. Even a heavy wind could keep a helicopter from landing on the LZ on 950. It was a pretty precarious landing zone. There was no fresh water available unless we flew it up, except to let them go out on a patrol. And I had some concerns about them going out on patrol and having some casualties that we would be unable to evacuate. But they did run out of, they were getting dangerously close to running out of water. So I gave the platoon leader permission to take them to go out on patrol. And they not only were able to bring back some water, but they surprised a rather lethargic North Vietnamese unit, just kicked the hell out of them and inflicted some casualties on the North Vietnamese and brought back some water. The most important point, I think, is that it lifted their spirits. I think the people on 950 sort of felt that they were up in the balcony watching the action on down in Kasan or on 881 or 861, but not really being part of it. So I think it helped raise their spirits immeasurably.
Okay, well, I mean, this is a good point that you, of course, were most concerned with the Kasan base. I've got a series of questions here that I've been asking. This is something which it's a general question. And I've asked it one way or another of the various people we've interviewed. How did people get through all this, the pressure, you know, the length of time, tremendous strain on the nerves and so on? And we've gotten different answers. Some people have said something about Marine Corps tradition. Two of the youngest guys said they figured, well, this is going to be in the history books, the Marine Corps history, and they damn well better do a good job, or you know, they'll read the book later on and they get in trouble. But there are a lot of other things that you know. What got the Marines through this thing in a successful manner?
Well, I think, in my experience, that, well, first of all, I sort of felt that I was well prepared to to be not necessarily a caisson, but to be an infantry battalion commander. I had come in the Marine Corps when I was 18. I had gotten a commission when I was age 20, gone to Korea, had a rifle platoon in the Korean War. I'd always, and from then on, I always wanted a rifle, I mean, an infantry type command. When the promotion slowed down between wars, I was in that, what I considered to be one of the best ranks, and that's the rank of captain. Nobody was getting promoted, so I was a captain for 8 years, so that gave me an opportunity to be a company commander for quite a few times. I was a rifle company commander in the 1st Division at Camp Pendleton, rifle company commander in Okinawa with the 3rd Marine Division. I had other training type commands, infantry training type commands. And then when I became a lieutenant colonel, well, when the war started in Vietnam, I desperately wanted to get there. I happened to be an advisor in Korea, to the Korean Marine Corps in 1964. When the war started, I was able to get a short assignment to Vietnam as an advisor to the Korean Marines. So I was able to get to Vietnam in 1965 briefly, and then kept requesting to get back to Vietnam, and was able to do so in the summer of 67. And at that time, was my strong desire to be an infantry battalion commander, because that's what I had trained for and that's what I wanted. It wasn't the fact that, you know, get your ticket punched or things like that. I just felt that I was best at being an infantry commander, because I enjoyed it. I liked being with the men. And to me, it was just a question that I was where I wanted to be. And I think another thing was the training that all of us had, from the youngest Marine, the newest Marine, all the way up, just like the Sergeant Major that I mentioned. There's a man that had been a prisoner of war and taken at the Battle of Bataan. And yet, when he had the opportunity, when he wanted to come to Vietnam, he wanted to serve in an infantry battalion. He did not shirk it. And I think the camaraderie of the Marine Corps, the esprit de corps, which is not just a cliche. I think Marines have just a fantastic sense of humor. Sometimes can be a little grotesque, sometimes a little crude. You pick up the dialogue in the book that we were discussing earlier, Dispatches. I think he captured a lot of it. But it's just a tremendous feeling of not wanting to let down anybody. And this is what gets the rifleman, the man that's really out there in the trenches, so to speak. He's with his buddies. He doesn't want to let them down, and he'll do anything to keep his end up. I think from the point of view of a career officer, I think, as I said, it's where he wants to be, and he should relish it. And I think most of us did.
Okay, let me ask you this. What about incidents of humor? Here's another question that I've asked people. And that's one way, of course, to get through finding humor, even though it's black humor, in situations that occur.
Well, there are many. It's difficult to think back, but I can just recall some of the things that we used to do. That are not, when you look back, they don't have the humor that they did. We used to listen in the middle of the night to Radio Hanoi, and when the Radio Hanoi was Hanoi Han, I guess we call it.
By the way, just to break in here, I'm getting recordings of her broadcast from the CIA, and we will use this with some night material. So, I mean, this is relevant.
I think she used to announce that the flag of North Vietnam was now flying over Kaesong, which would always produce a laugh. I can recall, and the intelligence reports, I mean, we used to laugh at our own selves. one command post had a sign, because every night you'd get the word from the regiment, tonight's the night. I mean, the attacks come in the night, we know it, our radios have picked up this information. Well, they would never tell you how they picked it up, but you visualize, tonight's the night. Two regiments are coming here and one regiment's here. And so one outfit had a sign that said, tonight's the night, and they would flip that, or maybe if it wasn't tonight, it would say, tonight, not tonight, you know. And then I think one night, another rumor was that a biplane was flying down to attack Kasan. So we could visualize the guy in there with the goggles and with a hand grenade that he was going to attack me. It doesn't have any humor now, but in Kasan, in the darkest of the nights, it would be pretty funny. And of course, you'd always get stories from people coming back on R&R, with their, particularly the young single guys that had gone to Bangkok or Hong Kong. They always had tales to tell about their conquest or things like that. And I should be able to think of other things.